Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe, but I got to put you down.
Hello, everybody. I'm Patrick Connor, and welcome back to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. In just a minute, my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler, of course, author, filmmaker to the stars and whatnot, boxing trainer too, forgot that. He's going to be joining us in just a moment, and today we're talking the aftermath and, you know, recapping the Vasily Lomachenko win over Luke Campbell on ESPN this last weekend. It has definitely created a few, I don't want to say rifts, but it's definitely created a few waves. It's been a discussion point ever since it happened. I think the major discussion point is, well, is Vasily Lomachenko pound for pound? Well, where is he pound for pound? Does he compare to fucking Tyson Fury? I don't know. I mean, it always inevitably bleeds into this somewhat meaningless this guy versus so-and-so from history conversation with a lot of these fighters who are especially prodigious. And Vasily Lomachenko, of course, very prodigious, no exception in that department. And in my opinion, and we'll get to this a little bit more later and we'll see what Bryn has to say, but in my opinion, watching the fight, I thought that it was a closer fight than many people seem to have it. Many people, I think, seem to feel that Vasily Lomachenko's accuracy and how hard he was landing were definitely overcoming whatever activity Luke Campbell was managing, especially with his jab. And while I don't necessarily have a problem with that way of thinking, I think that it was also very clear, and this is something that I say every so often when it comes to how I talk about, or when I talk about how I score fights or something like that, but when you're actually scoring a fight, and it's obviously impossible to really really quantify how hard a punch is landing, how much it hurts a fighter who is absorbing it, and whether or not it has an actual effect. It's almost impossible. But one of the things that I like to say is that when you can see that a guy is throwing punches and having an effect with those punches, that's pretty important to me. And one of the things Luke Campbell was managing to do with just activity alone in the first handful of rounds was push Vasily Lomachenko back and disallow him from taking the opportunities that you could see he wanted. And you could see that in the first, I think, three rounds or so, Lomachenko looked a little frustrated. He looked like he was getting a little pissed off that he wasn't able to dial in as quickly as he generally would like to. He definitely took the first round, or round and a half or so, to get a look at Campbell and see what was coming at him, etc. So I don't want to begrudge him too hard here. But at the same time, I do think that he did not look particularly good, Lomachenko, that is, in the early going. He obviously dialed in later on in the fight, and as Luke Campbell started to tire and wasn't able to keep up that pace, Lomachenko took over, clearly. But I do think that it kind of raises a few questions, as a handful of Lomachenko's other fights have done. Now, another thing you kind of have to look at is, another thing you kind of have to look at is that when you are on this level, and if you're staying even remotely active or busy, you're going to have bad nights. It's inevitable, and especially so when you are willing to face just about any style. And that's not something you could say for every fighter in history, of course. Some fighters actively avoided certain styles and certain fighters in some cases. But Lomachenko is clearly willing to step in with just about anybody. I mean, the politics is a totally different story. But I think that that's important. And I think that you also kind of have to, I don't want to say throw him a bone for that. If a guy loses a fight, he loses a fight regardless of how active he's been or how, you know, what level he's on. But regardless, I think that you do have to kind of acknowledge that Lomachenko is willing to do these things and is still excelling, despite the fact that, you know, he people are bringing challenges to his doorstep, and they are getting up for his fights. That was the first few rounds was about as good as we've ever seen Luke Campbell look. I don't want to go overboard with any Luke Campbell praise, but I do think that he looked good and employed a very smart game plan in the early going. And so that being said, I don't really have, I obviously have no issue with the decision or anything like that, but I do think that we learned a few things from this fight. Bryn, what's up, dude?
Ooh, I'm excited about this one. I love these kind of contrasting boxing history episodes. These are my favorite.
Yeah, it's actually, so the contrast that Bryn's immediately bringing up here is what wound up happening this past weekend. So Vasily Lomachenko takes the decision over Luke Campbell. And in the immediate aftermath, I think what winds up happening with, and I said it earlier in the show a minute ago, but what winds up happening with a lot of these fighters that are really prodigious or really flashy, talented, and especially fighters who have a big amateur background and a lot of heft behind their record, even if it is just in the amateur sense, people are constantly reaching and looking for, like, where do they fit in? Where do they fit in history? Where do they fit in now on the pound-for-pound list? What does it mean? You know, et cetera. Who's the best comparison and blah, blah, blah. And I think that what wound up happening was that William Detloff this past weekend tweeted that he essentially said something along the lines of, I'd have to find it, but he said something along the lines of, with Lomachenko, we're seeing what we might have seen had Roy Jones been more willing to challenge himself or something like that. And what wound up happening with that tweet is Julian Williams, J-Rock, saw that tweet, and he obviously doesn't know William Detloff. And for those listening and going, Will, who? William Detloff is currently the editor of Ringside Seat magazine, that I know a lot of hardcore boxing fans have really gotten into. And he was, for a number of years, the assistant editor of The Ring. And what Julian Williams wound up saying was, you know, SMH, shaking my head, boxing fans, look at this guy. You know, somebody's trying to disrespect Roy Jones Jr. When I really don't think that's what Bill was trying to do at all. But then what, of course, wound up happening with that is that people just fucking piled on and were like, look at this faggot. Look at this fucking guy. This guy's a fucking fag. You know, it got kind of out of hand for a minute there. And I think that they were obviously with the knee-jerk reaction, what people were missing was, and this is obviously, this is mental masturbation here, that it doesn't do anything. Nobody's, you know, comparing Roy Jones to Vasily Lomachenko does nothing at all. But regardless, the larger point is that, again, trying to suss out where Lomachenko fits in, you know, in this big picture. Who does he compare to? Can we draw comparisons or recent comparisons? And I don't think that it's really that bad a comparison as far as what Bill Detloff was trying to say, but it got definitely, you know, a game of telephone happened and it kind of misconstrued and blah, blah, blah. But what you wound up saying is that, you know, what about this comparison then? That's actually kind of an interesting comparison.
Yeah, I think on the surface of it, I reacted pretty strongly against it, because I think Jones is just so special, and I think his legacy has been tarnished by the way it ended. And, you know, you have a new generation of boxing fans that didn't grow up with him, didn't see him at his peak. And something that I think that happens similarly with Michael Jordan is just Kobe Bryant or LeBron and younger people that never saw Jordan play, let alone in his prime, just have this assumption that these guys are bigger, or they're doing things that Jordan couldn't do, or the competition was different, where it's just like anybody who saw Jordan, it's just so obvious. But, you know, if your life was on the line, if your wife's life was on the line, and you had to pick one of these guys about who you'd want on your team to win, I don't know anybody who watched Jordan in his prime who isn't really, really clear on who the greatest player ever is. And yet it's a serious debate with younger people. And I think the same is true with Roy Jones Jr. Just as Max Kellerman put really eloquently, that for all the talk of Floyd Mayweather being the greatest fighter ever, mainly voiced by himself or acolytes of Floyd Mayweather Jr., he shared a prime with Roy Jones Jr. And while Jones was in his prime, there was not one person on earth who suggested that Mayweather was the better fighter between the two. It was, and the distance between Roy Jones Jr. and Floyd, Roy Jones opened as a 3-1 favorite against Mike Tyson when people sort of thought post-prison Tyson was, you know, an incredibly dominating, intimidating force. Jones after Ruiz opened up 3-1 as a favorite. Because the guy never lost a round, and the guy made fighters like James Toney and Bernard Hopkins look pedestrian. I mean, like, barely lost rounds to these guys, like, clowned these people. So, you know, whereas Floyd had serious trouble against Castillo, I think he lost the first fight and clearly had was very picky about who he fought also. So which isn't to say that Roy doesn't deserve criticism for eating up a lot of mandatories as well, but I just thought this is an interesting discussion because Vasily Lomachenko is moving into a territory where a knee-jerk reaction to him is he's this new generational talent, and I think he is, but it's then comparing him to Floyd Mayweather, comparing him to Roy Jones is an interesting thing, both in terms of their skill sets and their resumes. So I just thought it would be exciting to go to the most extreme version of a generational talent with Roy Jones Jr. and look at where Lomachenko compares.
Well, I'll just go open up and say that, you know, as far as this whole Jordan thing goes, and now I'm not an NBA expert. I'm not even really a fucking basketball fan. I was alive during the Jordan era. And, you know, my dad's a college basketball coach. And so I've grown up around a lot of this shit. One of the things that Michael Jordan did, and one of the reasons why so many people who especially were alive during that time and got to see it, are maybe not so much insulted, but just kind of like nonplussed by the comparison between Jordan and LeBron and Kobe and all these dudes. You know, it's easy to look down at the piece of paper and say, well, this guy had this many rings and this guy had this many, so he wins. You know, that's not how it works. And anybody who has ever played basketball knows that that's not how it worked. And I will get to back to the boxing in just a moment, I swear. But one of the things that Michael Jordan did constantly that made him, if not the greatest player, one of the greatest players, was he was constantly making his teammates look good. Constantly. He was, you know, not just leading in scoring or leading in this or leading in that, but he's leading in assists. The guy was constantly passing to his teammates and, you know, making sure that the team was good. And he had no problem pulling a clutch shot if he needed to, or taking that opportunity out of somebody else's hands if he felt like that was necessary. But anyway, that's the whole my whole thing with Jordan and LeBron and all those things. But when it comes to comparing Roy Jones to Lomachenko, it's tough. I think that one of the mistakes that a lot of people make, because it's convenient, because it's really the only quantifiable thing that you can reach for, it's really the only thing that you can see on paper is, you know, the championships. Well, so-and-so's a four-division champion. Well, this guy's a three-division champion, so four is bigger than three. There you go. That's not how it works. You know, if this were an era where every title were unified or undisputed or something like that, and it, I don't even care. You can name a year. It doesn't really matter. I don't care if it's not a, you know, a history bias. It's a fact bias here. You know, there are so many splintered fucking titles that if you're coming up telling me so-and-so is 19-2 in championship fights in 2019, I don't care. I'm 100% serious. I don't care. That means nothing to me, because you could be defending a title that just in the last three fucking years has all of a sudden become important when 10 years ago people were dismissing it offhand. So where do I go with that? What do I do with that information? He's a 14 division titleist. Okay. Well, they just created like 9 new divisions last year. What does that mean? So that's my point, is that a lot of the comparisons that are being drawn here, especially historically, and especially by people who not trying to be ageist, but weren't around for it, and so don't remember the criticism. Dude, Roy Jones got criticized a ton. And that's actually one of the funny things about this entire debate surrounding what William Detloff had said, was that him being the associate or the assistant editor of The Ring, especially during that time period, he has a very intimate knowledge of what people thought about Roy Jones Jr., what pundits thought about Roy Jones Jr., and what fans did, because they received letters constantly. So it's not like he's – the responses that I saw to him were like, this guy doesn't even know what he's talking about. And not once did I see him pull rank and be like, bro, I was the editor of The Ring for a couple of years. I didn't see him say that once. So my point is simply that people are just kind of – taking their stance and then just like turning it up to 11 and going with it without looking at really any of the facts. Like, you know, Vasily Lomachenko, for instance, like just as a quick example, if you look at his box rec record and you see any WBO titles on there, a handful of years ago, nobody would have been counting that. So people can say all they want about the WBO title, about this title, about that title. A handful of years ago, nobody would have been counting that. And therefore, Lomachenko would not have been a world titleist in that time. I mean, it's splitting hairs. It's simply just that if you step back a little bit, you know, allow even just a couple minutes to pass, and then you take a, you look at it with a, just a more critical eye, it's not what you think. And that's what's so just aggravating about this particular argument, especially on the internet. Any fucking internet argument's aggravating. But this particular one is that the context is just totally left out of it. And, I mean, if you asked me, like, who has the better, blah, blah, I don't know, man. Roy Jones is obviously going to be rated higher in history because of what he's accomplished, and Lomachenko hasn't even come close to that. And I don't see anything he could do that could make him, but... Regardless, I do think that it is an interesting point. And one of the ways in which I do think that it's an interesting point, and I think that this is partially what William Detloff was getting at, was that during his prime, take that out of it, whatever, from the years probably like 96 to 97 or so to maybe about 2001, 2002, during those years, Roy Jones made it abundantly clear that he did not give two shits who anybody thought was the best in the world about this or this. He didn't care who the fans wanted him to face. He didn't care who anybody else wanted him, what anybody else wanted him to do. And he said it numerous times. And one of the ways in which we could view that and see that it's true is the Darius Mikulchevsky matchup. And that gets dismissed very quickly by saying, well, look at Mikulchevsky. Roy would have kicked his ass. Probably. I think Roy probably would have. But Mikulchevsky hit hard. He threw a lot of punches. He was very physically strong. And he was actually a much better boxer than people gave him credit for being. And actually, funnily enough, despite the fact that during the time, people were like, oh, well, Darius Mikulchevsky is just living off Roy Jones' scraps. It was actually the opposite more often than not. So it's kind of funny how that winds up working out ledger-wise. But I think that his refusal to challenge himself during this time, despite the fact that writers, fans, etc., were going, hey, dude, we're not watching this next pay-per-view with Ricky Frazier, the part-time cop. And that pay-per-view wind up getting like 120,000 frickin' buys or something like that, and something that was right. Considered a really massive failure. My point is that just during this time, the good things about Roy Jones Jr., you know, the hindsight, everything, all those things, it like wipes away that time period where he was very heavily criticized. And last little asterisk point here, HBO was forced to change the way they dealt with boxers because of how Roy Jones Jr. exploited his HBO contract.
Right. True.
And I think that what's really unfortunate about this discussion is that it's being taken as, well, the white people like the white guy in Lomachenko, so they're going to do anything they can to criticize Roy Jones. If people truly believe that, that's fine. I don't think anybody's going to be able to change their mind. But this is a fact. Roy Jones was heavily criticized during that period, and that gets forgotten because of the other things, understandably so. But it does need to be mentioned if we're, you know, running it down.
I think that that's a totally legitimate counterpoint to what I was saying, just in terms of Roy's superb athleticism, you know, where just there was this clear talk of this is like our generation's Ali, like the young Ali, and just like that we've never seen anything like this. And you could tell, like, even how athletes in other sports regarded him, Michael Jordan signing him to the Jordan brand and stuff like that. And I agree. I mean, Roy faced a lot of criticism. I couldn't stand Roy in a lot of ways, his personality as a fighter. I couldn't wait for him to slow down so that somebody would have a chance to just knock him out, because I thought he was incredibly disrespectful to his opponents. Like, I only really became a fan of Roy after getting to know him, and that he's not like he was, you know, like the rapper Roy. I thought he was a poor loser with Tarver, you know, like in the lead up to their rematch. Like, that was the greatest opener ever to a fight. Like, that was better than any boxing movie screenwriters ever come up with. What's your excuse going to be tonight, Roy? You could see on his face, Roy, who was never scared going into fights, was like, whoa, this is not going to go well, because this guy, I think it's going to be his night. You could just see it on Roy's face. So I don't know. Roy is such an interesting character in boxing, because I agree, there's something really divisive about kind of how exceptional he was, and that in his prime, did he really test himself the way Ali clearly did post-Vietnam, just taking on anybody. Roy also, you know, early in his career, you can look, if you go to Box Rec, how many fights he had just in his backyard in Pensacola, because his dad was really protecting his career in a lot of ways. They didn't want him to go in hard early. They could have, you know, early on. I think his second fight, he's in Atlantic City, and you can kind of see how big Roy was like, whoa, like we're going to be a little careful here. You know, we're going to look after Roy a little bit and get him to a place where gradually he's got the right opponents to get where he needs to go. Very similar to how Tyson was managed, heavily criticized early in his career that Bill Caton and Jim Jacobs were protecting him. Who has he really fought? Oh, wow, he's knocked out Marvis Frazier in 30 seconds. Who the fuck is Marvis Frazier in the scheme of things, as other people are getting carried away about how much potential he has, about where he's going to land as a great heavyweight? So with Lomachenko, who I think is an extraordinary talent, and I think you could make a strong argument that Lomachenko in his prime compared to, say, Floyd in his prime, Floyd could never lead the dance the way Lomachenko could, and then maybe they're comparable counterpunchers. But Floyd never was, you know, taking over fights to dominate fights in his prime against elite-level competition. But then again, you know, Lomachenko's been dropped. Lomachenko has the Salido fight where he's hitting the balls 400 times. You know, Floyd was a lot more risk-averse than Lomachenko. I would give Lomachenko credit for taking more risks in trying to be great, but, you know, these are what make these discussions interesting. You know, and then Roy, in comparison to Floyd and Lomachenko, has knockout power that clearly Lomachenko and Floyd never had. So that's, you know, another thing where Roy is on a bit of a different level. He has a different tool to add to his calculus about what makes him a great fighter. So this is, I think, what makes it fun to debate, not just the resumes, but, you know, or how they faced adversity. Roy, obviously, with Montel Griffin, that was the first time he really faced adversity as a fighter. And the guy who came in the rematch is maybe the greatest person I've ever seen fight in my lifetime.
You mean RJ?
Yeah, Roy. That Roy in the Montel Griffin rematch was
no,
like
his persona, RJ, that he adopted the rematch.
God.
His evil persona.
All that stuff I hate. And he apologized for the way he fought. And it was like he landed an uppercut that Lomachenko hasn't even dreamed of throwing. And Lomachenko can do everything. Can throw, like, probably has the best arsenal of any fighter who's ever lived in terms of how many punches he has, how much leverage he can achieve throwing them, the angles he's able to find, how quickly he can find angles. And yet Roy could do things that I don't know if any fighter in history has ever been able to do. We always attribute it to athleticism instead of how hard he worked. But nonetheless, like going back, watching some of the highlights of Roy in his prime, I don't know where else I would go to see the next best guy in terms of what Roy was able to do. But I mean, how often was he doing it against elite level competition? You're quite right to criticize him, to say he definitely used up a lot of his prime, chewing up a lot of man stories on HBO's dime. So yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and I mean that's not an insignificant part of this formula here too, the fact that Roy was able to, and don't get me wrong, because it sounds like I'm picking on Roy, when I guess if you were to word it another way, you could say that rather than Roy exploited his HBO contract, you could say that Roy took control of his career. I mean, yeah. You could say that, just in the same way that people say, well, Floyd Mayweather wasn't a cherry picker. He took control of his career. Okay. I mean, I suppose you could say that on some level, both are true.
Oh, but, yeah. I totally. Why? Who would criticize Floyd if you're one of Floyd's family members or you're on Team Mayweather? Who would criticize the way he operated his career? He did it better than anybody maybe in the history of sports. I mean, is that outlandish to say? Like,
And that being said, you know, like as far as Roy goes, he did exploit the HBO contract, and it did force HBO to say, well, damn, maybe we need to be far more careful about, or maybe we need to in the future not sign a guy for X amount of years and then guarantee X million dollars per fight, regardless of who the fighter is that he's fighting.
Right.
Maybe we shouldn't do that. And I don't think that they really felt a fighter would be able to take advantage of that opportunity the way that Roy did. And on top of that, you know, I think that it was also part of it was the lack of depth in the light heavyweight division at the time. But regardless, you know, one of the things that you had said earlier, and also what I had kind of forgotten to say, I don't want to bring this back to the basketball too much, but what reminded me was that when people say, you know, never seen this before, you know, Lomachenko does shit you never seen, this is crazy, and it's like, it's, first of all, obviously athletes are evolving, and there's going to be every generation somebody who's done something, even if it's a small thing, that you literally haven't seen before. That's just the nature of, you know, fucking people evolving and, you know, time, blah, blah, blah. It's just how it goes. So it's not, you know, it's not unexpected that somebody's going to do something new every so often. But we have seen before people throwing uppercuts from weird angles. We've seen before people throwing, you know, leaping left hooks or, you know, blah, blah, blah. We've seen almost everything that Vasily Lomachenko has been doing, we've seen before on some level. You know, it's not, excuse me, a little under the weather, sorry. But everything that we've seen him do, somebody's done before. Somebody's an ex-division champion before, blah, blah, blah. But one of the glaring weaknesses that you kind of touched on, and there are weaknesses, he's not invincible. He has been knocked down. He has been in some very difficult fights. And his loss, I mean, it kind of depends. There's a debate, too, as far as, you know, whether or not those early, what were they, the, I can't remember what they're called, the World Series of Boxing, I think they're called. Mm-hmm. They're like semi-pro.
Yeah.
Like, and there's a debate as to whether or not those should count as amateur or pro. Regardless, you know, it doesn't really matter because he won them.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you get paid to fight, so they probably should not be considered amateur fights. But it, in some sense, it doesn't really matter because he won them. But you know, a lot of this stuff we have seen before. But in that early fight against Orlando Salido, on the inside, he looked totally clueless. And he's obviously gotten much better at that in the years since that loss, which is great, obviously. You know, you want to see a fighter learning from a loss, but you can still see, and I think that we saw it with Luke Campbell, just kind of in snapshots, though. Luke Campbell is not the inside fighter to exploit this. And even so, he still wound up having moments, especially early in the fight, where Lomachenko was getting hit with punches on the inside that he didn't even see at all, which is not something you see from Lomachenko very often.
Especially to the body. Some of those body shots look brutal.
Some of them were pretty hard body shots, and he did literally nothing at all. Like, he didn't move into them. He didn't kind of try to take the mustard off by, like, you know, pivoting or weaving or anything like that. He just took them because he didn't see them. And it to me, that's a pretty clear indicator that he's very lacking on the inside still. And I don't know that he will ever not be lacking on the inside. And further, I don't know that there's really anybody around that could teach him that lesson again. Orlando Salido, for all of his losses and all of the bad things about him, and, you know, he's kind of a weird dude and has been caught on, you know, PEDs, I think, a couple times. For all of the weird things about him and his style, he's a very good inside fighter, very strong, and was exactly the fighter to kind of do to Lomachenko what he did. I don't really know that I see anybody around to do that again. But point is just that there are still holes in his game. He's not perfect. We have seen a lot of the things that he's been doing before. And I think that also speaks to Bill's point, Bill Detloff's point, that it's not, you know, we've seen a lot of this trajectory before. So it's an interesting comparison for a whole number of reasons. What I kind of am curious about is the attitude. You also touched on that too. The way that Roy acted during a lot of his career was a turnoff to me too. I'm not going to lie. I was never really a big fan, pretty much ever. I don't hate him. I wasn't like a Roy Jones hater. I didn't want to see him get knocked out every time I saw him, but it was just that I found it grating. Like Floyd Mayweather. For a little while, I called Floyd Mayweather Roy Jones Jr. Jr. just because I was so fucking annoyed by him. I was like, wow, all right, I guess he's just going to be, you know, really putting his fucking elbow into this being the villain thing and, you know, just going to do it to do it. And because he knows it's going to piss people off, not because, you know, it's just fucking, come on, dude. And I hated that about Roy. And I found it annoying. And I remember that when he got disqualified against Montel Griffin, I did kind of like it, at least on some level, because I was like, all right, maybe this is going to teach him a lesson. And one of the thing was, it didn't really. It didn't really teach him anything at all. But what it did do was piss him off. And you got to see that when Roy was pissed off and motivated, that he was a scary fighter. But that even made it worse. Because then it was like, all right, so that's what we could be getting? What the fuck? Why don't we get that every time? But then you start to realize, well, if you got that every time, then you wouldn't have this dude that's like 40-1. If you got that every time, he'd be like, you know, 31-9 or something. But I mean, that is exactly the thing. That's the name of the game here, is that it's far more lucrative. It makes far more sense to these fighters, and it makes more sense to their brains, makes more sense for their long-term health, to protect themselves and to smartly maneuver through a career rather than, you know, just jump dick first into a fight, every fight. And then you wind up with a record like Orlando Salido's. So I guess that's kind of partly the lesson here.
No, I think that's an interesting place to compare the two also, was just how fans regarded them. Because I think you're right. I think with Jones, everybody recognized the potential, but the feeling was that he left a lot on the table. And people resented that. People resented it because, you know, if you want to compare yourself to Ali, Ali is somebody where we knew the price he paid, not just, and he also had the two careers. You know, Roy had the young Ali career, the Cassius Clay career, and was, I would argue, just as dazzling as Clay, but where Ali became Ali and slowed down, Roy slowing down didn't have any of those great victories that Ali had. Quite the contrary. You know, a series of brutal, iconic knockouts that he suffered, and had the same stubbornness, the same addiction to his career, fame, his identity as a fighter, but they both just suffered such an incredibly enormous toll. And you know, we had to watch it. So I mean, I agree with you. I immensely disliked Roy because of his arrogance and the way he treated other fighters. I just found it so distasteful how disrespectful he was and how much he seemed to relish humiliating opponents. Floyd, yeah, I mean, I didn't like him, but I mean, he was an exciting fighter earlier in his career and really did have to fight a lot of really, really tough guys. After what happened with Castillo, to come back and put on the performance he did, I gave him a lot of credit for it. But at the same time, Floyd was somebody that couldn't market his style ever until he created the persona. When he fought Arturo Gatti to really get over with the public, I mean, I think 98% of people who were at that fight, who bought that fight, were Gatti fans. You know, Mayweather couldn't sell anything. And I've said it many times, Mayweather, there's never been a great fighter who was more content to be booed out of the ring with a unanimous decision than Floyd. Once he had your money paying for the ticket or the pay-per-view, he'd won in his mind. He had no allegiance whatsoever to his legacy being exciting fans or giving what Ali or other great fighters gave. His attitude was, you know, if he could cherry pick the metric that made him the best ever, he was gleefully going to do it. So with Lomachenko, I think there is a real willingness to take risks, and I give him credit for it because it makes his fights really exciting. I mean, I don't think Luke Campbell is a Hall of Fame fighter, but he was a game young guy, and Lomachenko was hurt in the fight with a body shot, and you saw how he came back from it. I think, you know, we're seeing things from Lomachenko every time he's fighting, not just the incredible athleticism, but we're seeing his character on display as well. And you know, with Roy's career really takes a serious turn after he fights John Ruiz, and then it becomes something radically different when he's fighting Tarver, and then especially the rematch, and then, you know, hangs around for a 25-year career when probably if he'd retired after Ruiz, would he be in the discussion of top three fighters of all time based on accomplishments? Probably. Maybe.
I don't think so, but not because, I mean, I kind of have a slightly different view of it, though.
Okay.
For me, the later career losses don't do anything to downgrade him on an all-time scale for me. I know that that's, like, not generally the case. I know that a lot of the time when fighters fight on beyond their expiration date and wind up racking up losses, I think that since that is added, obviously, to the cumulative record of that fighter, people kind of focus on the cumulative record and say, well, he's got a lot more losses now. And that's true, but that doesn't take away any of the wins. So it really, for me, comes down to, like, are any of those wins, are those wins enough to put him on the kind of like an all-time great scale, like, you know, like that? And in my opinion, no. John Ruiz was, even at the time, the weakest heavyweight title holder, and it's still an accomplishment. One thing I'm very wary of doing a lot of these discussions is poo-pooing everything. Because if I fucking poo-poo everything, then nothing's special, you know? But regardless, I do kind of have to recognize that John Ruiz was the weakest title holder at the time. And by some rights didn't even deserve to have that title. Holyfield knocked him out, and I believe it was their second fight, with a body shot. John Ruiz played that shit off like it was a low blow, and Joe Cortez bought that shit. Joe Cortez is one of the worst fucking referees in the history of boxing. I will argue that shit till I die. He's awful. Anyway, he might not have even deserved to have that title, but regardless, he did. He had it. Roy Jones got it. But he made it also clear he wasn't even interested in defending it. And when fights against the other, you know, champions in the division were brought up, and they brought up the idea of a Lennox Lewis fight to him, I'm sure that somebody could Google this and find it. But when they asked him what it would take for him to get a fight with Lennox Lewis, he said $100 million. Now, in 2019, In 2019, that doesn't sound that crazy. In 2002, 2003, that was fucking nuts. And it was never going to happen.
Even more so, like, what kind of money did Roy make fighting anybody?
Exactly.
Like, where are Roy's super fights? They don't exist. They don't exist.
Where would that money have come from at all?
His career.
Is the thing. Yeah. Where would anybody have come up with that money? And nobody would have. Nobody. So that's basically, it's another way of saying I don't want to fight him. And understandably right. so, because Lennox would have absolutely smashed the shit out of him, even out of shape, the guy who showed up against Vitaly Klitschko. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in context, then, it's almost like saying, okay, well, Roy Jones moved up and beat, like, the fifth best heavyweight in the world, which is an accomplishment, for sure. But, you know, is it any better, for instance, than Mickey Walker in I think it was like 1931, going up, moving up, and getting a draw with Jack Sharkey, you know, who was far closer to any sort of heavyweight championship than actual heavyweight champion than John Ruiz. And I mean, it's a rhetorical question because there is no answer, but there is an asterisk to that. And to answer your question more straightforward, I mean, nah, I don't really think that there's an argument to make Roy Jones top 3, 5, 10 all time. I think that, like I said, there's a lot of hindsight in play. Roy Jones is a funny character now. He's a more beloved. He's somebody that a lot of people have seen on social media and have gotten a lot more cozy with or whatever now. And he's not the cantankerous jerk he was viewed as in the 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, Lennox Lewis, very similarly, a lot of people didn't like Lennox Lewis, but now he's retired. Time's gone by. People love that fucking guy. So I think that that's kind of a lot of what's coming into play here too. But to just rewind it a tad to what you had said, I agree. I think that it's dumb for anybody to not see Lomachenko as a very, very, very good fighter. And one of the things that I really like about him is his dedication to evolving as a fighter, his dedication to learning and getting better, to seeing what he's doing wrong and learning from it. I think that that's something that's really admirable. He's obviously adding things to his game, trying different ways of training. You know, I think that a lot of them are flashy and a lot of them are kind of just for show, which is cool. You know, he's also embracing the kind of like, you know, I'm a character part of it. But I do think that you do have to recognize also that Lomachenko, he should be fairly high on the pound for pound list. I don't think that he's number one, but he should be fairly high. He's obviously a very, very, very good fighter. And I do think that more often than not, it's pretty fun to watch him do his thing. And another thing that I don't think that we've said is that the Luke Campbell fight was actually really fun.
Super fun.
Sorry, I'm kind of just like hogging the microphone here, but you're like, my brain's firing and I'm like, well, man, I got to respond to everything he said.
No. I think everything you're saying is on point. And I thought the Campbell fight was a lot of fun too. And I generally find Lomachenko to be a really fun fighter in a way that somebody I thought had as much talent, Rigondeaux, was not a fun fighter most of the time and was very willing to be an unfun fighter despite, you know, such incredible skills. So I give Lomachenko credit for that. Like, I like that he's exciting people with his talent and he's willing to take risks. It is exciting. I mean, we are cheering people on by being on the edge of our seats. And, you know, Lomachenko fighting Gervonta Davis, being willing to fight Inoue, I can't wait to see these fights. I think these are extraordinary fights to watch, and they're dangerous for him, and I think he wants them. I love his competitiveness. Like, I've only interviewed Lomachenko once, just before he fought Rigo, but he has this kind of, like, it reminded me of, what's that film with Jude Law, Enemy at the Gates, where you've got him and Ed Harris as assassins, and that's the way Rigo and Lomachenko were. Like, they were the preeminent assassins in the world getting ready to fight each other, and it was just life and death as far as they were concerned. They're both so singularly unpleasant to be around in the lead up to a fight, but in a way that's amazingly compelling. Like, I was so enjoying just how they're like, I will go in. I will, I will dispatch with this inferior threat to my supremacy. But, you know, he has this air. He has a lot of charisma that is based not just on how talented he is, but how hard he's worked to get there. And he's got his own flavor of that, which is so much fun to have because it, you know, it transcends boxing. It becomes he's a world-class athlete that we're seeing in his prime. Lomachenko's 31. Every time we're watching him, he's not going to be able to do this at this level for very much longer. So I'm glad that he seems game to fight the best that's out there right now. And these are really worthwhile challenges with Davis and Inoue. And who knows, you know, 2-3 years, if he's able to put some great challenges on his resume, where his legacy will land. But, you know, it's fun to watch while it's going on. And, you know, Roy Jones, I agree. I was incredibly frustrated through much of his career where it was sort of like watching a, you know, a team sport where there's a great player on a shitty team where you, you know, like Jordan before he had anybody around him, it was fun, you know, just because he was so dazzling, but it wasn't, you just knew he couldn't get where he should be, you know, he in terms of winning titles and championships and that kind of thing. And there was something about Roy that was okay being so dominant against inferior competition that was a little bit unseemly for a while. And the way he, I don't know, behaved in that situation, as you mentioned earlier, contemptuous of any criticism of it, was it was really hard to like him. You know, at least with Mayweather, you look at that resume, and I think he was selective also, you know, selective when he was fighting people and stuff like that. But he was forced because he couldn't sell tickets to fight a lot of people where he didn't have any agency to really dominate the conditions under which he fought people. And he found a way to win all those fights. You know, Floyd was so, so tough mentally, such a consummate winner. And it's different now that he's retired, looking back on the fights he figured out, some tough fights that he had, you know, pulling a win out. Whereas Roy, when Roy met adversity, when Roy slowed down, it was very different than some other great fighters when they slowed down, where they had to adapt. Roy didn't really have an ability to adapt as a fighter. There wasn't exactly a plan B. And with Lomachenko, you're seeing this evolution where I don't know what he's going to be when he slows down, when his feet aren't so quick and his hands aren't so quick and he's not in such unbelievable conditioning where he's such a voluminous puncher. But I still think he's going to be incredibly fun to watch and maybe more exciting as he slows down, like Ali was, more exciting once guys, you know, he couldn't get away from punches and was getting hit. Lomachenko's already getting hit, despite how good he is.
Well, I think that, you know, perhaps at least part of the wider point is that, well, first, Luke Campbell is a pretty good fighter. He's not
great
just
fighter.
Some scrub. Good is kind of remains to be seen. You know, it's not fully clear yet, but he's pretty good. And we already know that he's
level.
Good enough on an amateur level to have won, you know, an Olympic medal. So anyway, that's part of it. And also, you know, flipping to the Roy Jones thing, another part is that I don't want to focus too much on the quote-unquote bad part of Roy's career or to suggest that that part of his career also takes away, you know, from the wins or anything like that, kind of like how I said earlier about the later part of his career. But with Lomachenko, I do kind of wonder with, you know, what you had just said, I do kind of wonder with him being 31. Now, 31, especially in 2019, is not considered old at all in boxing. But 31 with, I don't even think that he knows for sure, but something like, you know, 300 or 400 amateur fights, you know, however many amateur world titles and blah, blah, blah. I do kind of wonder if there's far more mileage on him than people realize, even though he's not that old. And am I saying that, like, oh, this fight is the start of his decline? No, not saying that. But I do wonder. if he is kind of slowing down a little bit because of that just massive amount of amateur experience from a very young age. If he's going to start burning out quicker than we realize, I'm not saying he is, just wondering if he is. So I think that that is kind of something to keep in mind, but we also did see a little bit of him sitting down and getting pissed. I think partially out of frustration. One of the things that I had said right before you had hopped on was about the Luke Campbell fight was that I thought it was a little bit closer than many people seem to. Many people felt that the kind of like 11-1, 10-2 was like right in range as far as the scorecards. I thought it was a little closer to like 8-4. Maybe 9-3.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm with you there. I think 8-4 is very reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking for something else. But yeah, I thought that about 8-4 was a little bit closer, you know, plus the knockdown, obviously. But that I saw Lomachenko clearly having some issues with what was going on in there. And again, not saying it's the start of the decline, but I think that it's partially, you know, what we could expect to see when he does slow down is him having to sit down on punches more, having to perhaps stay in the pocket a little bit more. And if he does stay in the pocket, like I was saying earlier, I'm not confident in his infighting ability, really.
Well, and I think Patrick also is just, he's just taking more chances. You know, it, like Floyd was never leading the dance, and Lomachenko does a lot. He takes the fight to people, and part of that is, unlike Floyd, who had that brilliant right-hand counter, ducking away from something and flinging his right hand and then ducking away and resetting, Lomachenko throws 2-3 punches as a counter. He counters in combination. Floyd never did. Floyd wasn't capable of doing it, and Floyd knew that if he did, he was going to start getting hit. And, you know, how many really solid punches did Floyd take in his career when he became, you know, I think when the hands really relegated him to being much more defensive than he had to be early on. Lomachenko is somebody who's quite willing to take risks. I think he prides himself on fighting a certain way, and he likes to dominate people. I think in a different way than Floyd, who just knows what's necessary to win the round, I think Lomachenko really wants to take control of fights and assert his dominance over opponents in a way that I just think for Floyd, it was immaterial. You know, it was kind of irrelevant. Once I've won the fight, I've maintained the zero, I move on to the next thing and it's more lucrative. Lomachenko, like, I don't see that having a loss in any way has diminished his sense of who he is and his sense of his place in boxing. And, you know, and I think it's interesting just that he's, you know, he's moving up. I've heard he wants to come back down to 130 as a natural weight. It was quite astounding to see him stand next to Campbell, how much bigger Campbell was. You know, fighting at 135, Lomachenko is a small guy. I mean, he's small when you see him, and yet towering over Rigondeaux when they were next to each other. But I mean, we forget, like, you watch these guys on TV, when you're next to them, they look like jockeys. You know, they're 5'5", 5'6", 125 pounds, soaking wet. It's, I wonder what's going to happen to him as he notices his reflexes slowing down, because it seems like his training camps and the people around him are so scientific, measuring everything, mental acuity, physical coordination. He doesn't train the way most boxers do, the way Floyd did or Jones. And I also think another important fact is that I don't think Lomachenko's juicing. I don't really see any evidence with him that really jumps out at me that, you know, he seems like he's been in this condition his whole career, how hard he works, the focus. None of it really strikes me as he's a fighter on performance-enhancing drugs, whereas I think a lot of stuff points to that Floyd was juicing in the same way that, you know, it was a similar situation to Barry Bonds looking at Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa and thinking, what the fuck? Like, I mean, if these guys can be this talented on drugs, if this is Pacquiao on drugs, I need to get on this. Lomachenko, I think, is a clean athlete. Now, I don't have any evidence to support that, but I mean, is that your sense? Do you see him as a clean fighter when you're watching him?
It's really tough for me to know who is or who isn't at this point.
Sure.
I mean, I think it's almost impossible for anybody to know who is or who isn't. And that's just kind of the cynic in me. And also the realist in knowing that there's simply more money in cheating the tests than in testing. So, you know, that's always how it's going to be. So the cheaters are always going to be ahead of the testers all of the time, no exception. That being said, you know, there are levels here, and I do think that Lomachenko does not strike me as somebody who is, you know, trying to gain any other advantage in that sense, because, I mean, at least partially because of his training regimen. He's very open on social media about a lot of the stuff that he does. It's also very clear that he stays in the gym. And
yeah.
I think that it's less likely for a lot of fighters to get injured and to, you know, et cetera, if they're staying in the gym than if they're, you know, fighting twice a year and then all of a sudden having to, you know, dedicate half a training camp to losing weight type of stuff. I think that it's a totally different kind of fight it's a totally different kind of game. When a fighter is able to do that, to actually stay in the gym, stay out of trouble, stay away from alcohol, eat right, et cetera, it's a totally different thing. It's a different approach. So I think that there would also just be less need to take any performance enhancers from him in that regard. So, yeah, I think that it's probably more likely that he's clean than not, or than other fighters who are adhering to the formula I was just talking about.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, I remember seeing Gamboa in between fights blowing up in weight, looked like 20 pounds, 25 pounds. There's a photograph of him in the gym where he just had like a gut. And just being like, next time I saw him in the ring, that body had just snapped back into incredible shape. And I was like, yeah, these are the sort of telltale signs of the people who bounce around 10, 15 pounds, especially at those light weights. That's a pretty big flag to at least ask some questions. And, of course, I know he was lumped in with that South Florida anti-aging clinic along with a lot of other athletes, including A-Rod. But, no, it seems like Lomachenko has been dialed in since he was a little kid and still seems to enjoy it. You know, it's not like a lot of these other fighters who get to where he is, who sort of say, you know, like Roy Jones was talking about retiring in his mid-20s. He was sort of talking about not ending up like Ali, and I would only take one loss. And there was all this HBO footage of him going to schools and talking to kids. You're never going to see me end up like those kind of people. Lomachenko, I get a sense that he really enjoys being there, and I get a sense he enjoys training. And, you know, what you raised earlier about the wear and tear of having 400 amateur fights and you know, he's been doing this for 20 years now, give or take. That was the thing when Rigo came over to the U.S. at 28, 29 years old, and I interviewed his strength and conditioning coach and said that Rigo was the greatest athlete he'd ever dealt with. I said, like, what is the thing that you've noticed working with him that's the Achilles heel? And he was like, it's the same for everybody, age. There's just no way this body can keep doing what it's been doing. And in his mind, he's just so conditioned to think that it can. So at some point, there's going to be a discrepancy between what you believe you can do and what your body can actually do to meet you there. And probably the last person to recognize that is the athlete himself. Lomachenko, I still just see so much technique to complement the athleticism. So it's going to be interesting to see the adjustments or if he's going to make adjustments as he slows down a little bit. But there's so much technique to rely upon. There's wonderful YouTube videos that just do breakdowns of all of his movements. And I mean, even trying to imitate some of the moves that he does in his fights, watching it in slow motion is difficult because they're just, from like a dancing perspective, so technically sophisticated, let alone like conceiving of doing them against elite level competition. Just trying to do it as you're watching your computer, it's you strain, like even just to mentally understand how he's doing what he's doing. He's just such a marvel at this point. I hope he stays in boxing for at least 3-4 years, but who knows? I mean, a shoulder injury, a hand injury, it can completely change the complexion of his career, the way it, you know, I think it did with Floyd with the hand injuries, or a number of other fighters having injuries. You know, Tyson before prison and after prison is a totally different fighter. It's just that people didn't really appreciate the defensive genius he had, that he was a counterpuncher before prison. He's a pressure counterpuncher. Well, he's just a puncher after he comes out of prison. He never went back to that defense and the footwork, and I think just being in condition the way he was earlier. But it's hard to see it in real time, especially when these fighters are telling you things about where they're at, and we believe them. We sort of default to trusting them, but often they're trying to sell their opponents on where they're at, as opposed to being, you know, transparent.
He does definitely strike me as somebody who would, he strikes me as somebody, and I guess not just strikes me, he's pretty much said it, that he's somebody who's competitive with just about everything he does, that he picks mm-hmm. something up and wants to be the best at it. I definitely don't have that kind of athletic, you know, innate athletic ability. I always loved sports when I was a kid, and I played almost every sport you can think of. I wasn't good at all of them, but now in my later life, when it comes to other things that are not, you know, athlete related, I kind of can relate. Like, it's, I pick up a book on a subject, and if it interests me, then it's like, I want to fucking know everything. You know, so I can totally understand what, you know, what that's like, at least on some other totally nerdy, fat, hairy guy level. But he is like that, where like, if he weren't a fighter, if he were a soccer player, tennis player, something like that, he seems like he would be, if not the best, he would be definitely leaving no stone unturned in terms of effort, as far as going, you know, to be the best, that you wouldn't have to worry about whether or not he's, whether or not he's done the research and done the homework, that he's doing everything he possibly can. You know, I he's not a guy, Vasily Lomachenko is not a guy that I expect to come into a fight saying, yeah, I don't think he's going to be in very good shape. Or, I don't think that he's going to know much about his opponent, or, you know, something like that. I feel like he's somebody who's doing as much work and prep work as possible. And that's really all you can ask of a fighter. And he's getting results. The question, I guess, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I would add to that is that his mental toughness in executing all of that training is extraordinary. It's not just the preparation that goes into it. It's that, like Ali, when he steps into the ring, his willpower overwhelms opponents. I'll give you a good example of this. With Rigo, look at the way Lomachenko broke Rigo's will. He literally made him quit. And compare that with somebody like Donaire coming off massive knockouts that get him to be the ESPN Fighter of the Year. The moment Donaire faced adversity where it was like, I'm at real risk here. If I make one mistake, I'm going to get knocked out. This guy just technically is a lot better than anything I've ever seen. And I feel really in danger with I can't do what I've been so successful doing. And I don't want to try because this guy is just mentally a lot tougher than me. He has a willingness to, you know, stop this fight at any moment if I make a mistake. And I don't know how to adjust to deal with this. Compare that with Lomachenko going in against Rigo, probably the most technically superb fighter he's ever faced. He enjoyed that opportunity. That was pleasurable to him. It was a challenge to clown Rigo in ways that no fighters were opening up on Rigo because they'd seen what he could do. You make one mistake, his accuracy and his power, are going to can end fights to the body or to the head. This guy's one of the greatest counterpunchers who ever lived. And Lomachenko went in there almost laughing at that risk. That to me just showed, like, after, I don't know if it's a result of 400 amateur fights that he felt that he's seen everything, but clearly going in there against the best opponent he's ever faced, he delighted in that opportunity. Very, very few fighters are capable of that. Once they step in there, it being like a joyous opportunity to be challenged by that. Ali was that as a young person, and he was that when he slowed down. He broke the wills of opponents. And Lomachenko is as mentally tough, if not more, than the physical attributes by which he dominates opponents. So it's another facet that his opponents have to deal with. And it's immensely draining to be against somebody whose willpower we all have doubts at these moments of opportunity to define ourselves for who we are to ourselves and to our legacy. And to see a guy who's got a big smile on his face and is fighting with kind of joy, that's a really frightening thing. And Lomachenko does it every time he gets in there. He wants to assert that he's the greatest fighter who ever lived. And you can feel it.
I think that it's often kind of like downplayed a little bit when you hear, especially trainers and stuff like that, say, man, the fight's won in the gym. That's true on some level. You know, like, I get what they're saying. They're saying that you're going through these motions so many times in the gym, and that by going through those motions so many times, that's what's making these moves automatic. That's what's making you operate on a higher level. Where these other things that everybody else is having to think about, having to stop and consciously think about, you are not, because you've done them so many times. So therefore, the finer things are able to actually, you know, you're able to actually control those things rather than these other automatic movements. Like, I get it, and it's true. But it's not that it's not true. It's just that what you're saying is you still have to go in there and perform, and that going in there and performing is different from being in the fucking gym. You know, it's, you have to go out there, and especially fights on that level, on the level of like a Lomachenko Rigondo, where it's definitely considered kind of, if not pound for pound supremacy, some sort of supremacy, some indefinitely pound for pound implications. You know, there's a kind of a rivalry or a history there, et cetera, et cetera. And it's on a pro level, on a very high level, world class, etc. So stepping out into that ring under those lights, in front of the cameras, in front of the fans, and then having to actually execute there is still a pretty big part of actually getting it done, and is certainly the most difficult part of it.
Oh, I think it is. I mean, I think it's, there's a great documentary of Marlon Brando called Listen to Me, Marlon, where Brando talks about his great power as an actor was actually inspired by Archie Moore. He said, if you look at Archie Moore, his genius as a fighter is just how unpredictable he was with punches. He makes an opponent think it's coming here and brings a punch over there. And he said it's the same thing with acting, is you have to set them up so that your audience can never see where you're coming from. And yet every time you step out there, you're fighting this fear that you're going to be exposed, that you can't execute the way you have to, and you have to find a way, no matter how much you've accomplished in the past, that the moment you step on that stage and the cameras are rolling, that you're ready to just fucking knock everybody on their ass. This is a guy who showed up at Godfather where, as an Oscar winner, he had to do an audition just to get into the, you know, get the part. And, you know, he had to remind everybody that he's the best one ever to do it. But at the time, everybody doubted it. And he just had that ability to perform, you know, which is, there's a lot better fighters than we've ever seen actually perform who just couldn't do it outside of the gym. In the gym, there were probably some sparring sessions where some of the greatest fighters who ever lived dazzled the crowd in there. But if you brought them out to a ring in public and there's a camera rolling, they couldn't realize their potential. You know, they just didn't have it. And there's a lot of people out there who want to write a book. But the moment you say, like, here's the blank page to do it, they don't know what to do. There's all kinds of areas in life that are like that, where you can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't know how to perform at the moments that you have to perform and seize those opportunities, who gives a fuck about you in the end? Like, you're meaningless. And it's one of the reasons why I think I was so obsessed with Mike Tyson, is I was like, this is the most fucked up, oversensitive person who's ever existed as far as I can tell, and yet he was able to somehow keep it together to create the career that he did. You know, I'm astounded that he was ever able to, like, walk into a ring sort of thing. Whereas a lot of these other guys are just so tough by comparison. You know, Lomachenko, I didn't have any sense that Lomachenko is somebody who's particularly stressed out about, you know, having had 450 fights or whatever. Rigo, same thing. No stress about what his career is. Just matter of fact, like, they're just geared much more like soldiers. They've been this since they were little kids, just at, you know, the best that anybody's ever seen when they're doing it. It's 7, 8, 9 years old, and it just keeps on that way. So, I think it's another thing to consider when we look at these guys. Whereas, you know, with Roy is a tough-as-hell guy, but I think Roy had some real fears, and he talked about it in terms of Gerald McClellan and seeing some people get hurt and that kind of thing. I don't know that Roy was as willing to take some risks in there when there was adversity. I'm not sure. But Roy was great when he was dominating, but when adversity kind of struck, like, you know, he had to come back with Tarver. But in that second fight, he looked spooked to me. And Rigo looked spooked against Lomachenko, not when they walked in there, but very quickly seeing what Lomachenko had. It was kind of like, I don't want to bother with this. I just kind of want to get out of this.
And I think that also that I don't want to focus on it too much, but also that third fight with Tarver was kind of demonstrative too. Afterward, Roy said more or less in the interview that he was fighting to not get knocked out, that he wasn't fighting to win at all, that he didn't really care if he won. He was just trying to make sure he didn't get knocked out again. And I was like, wow, that's not anything I expected to come out of Roy Jones' mouth. He seems very competitive to me. So,
well, if you know your chin is vulnerable, you know, there's some shots that Roy's taken where he was knocked out that would have knocked out anybody. But,
sure,
you know, I just think it's fair to say nobody would say Roy Jones Jr. had a great chin. I mean, I don't think that that's a controversial take, whereas I think anybody would look at Muhammad Ali and say, this is probably the greatest chin in the history of boxing. You know, it's the thing that jumps out at me if you're comparing the two careers, is that when Ali slowed down and people could hit him, he could take the punches. Roy couldn't. Roy really couldn't. And it could be light heavyweights or, you know, really anybody, even guys not known as punchers, were just knocking Roy out cold. And, you know, earlier on in his career, he didn't get hit. It's kind of like Tyson. It was a moment if Tyson got hit with a clean punch when Tyson was Tyson. But Tyson had a pretty good chin. Wasn't Ali good, but also Tyson wasn't as gifted, I think, as Ali was, as complete a fighter as Ali. You know, he's too small. But Roy, just that chin was a real Achilles heel. And so if he's more reliant on his chin, there's going to be a lot more problems. And clearly that's where his career went.
And my old buddy, Cliff Rold, who writes for Boxing Scene and has written for a number of years, he's one of the guys I've known longest in boxing. One of the things that he had said a number of years ago, and I agree with, and it wasn't necessarily a criticism, it was just, I think, his way of trying to explain why Roy seemed to implode, you know, so quickly, you know, when he went from here, you know, went from the peak to the fucking nadir, you know, real quick. And I think that one of the things that he had said was that if you look back at his career, and even back into some of his amateur career, one of the things also his dad had said was that he didn't face very many punchers, and his dad tried to steer him away from punchers. One of the reasons, I mean, and Roy has kind of touched on this a number of times, he probably even mentioned it to you. I think that you have said so. It's been a couple of years, so I don't remember, but Gerald McClellan, being around Gerald McClellan and the amateurs and being somewhat close to him as far as, you know, fighting at the same tournaments and, you know, the amateur circles are small, and especially in regional, like for instance, Florida or the South, a lot of those fighters who rose, you know, the cream of the crop would have known each other. They would have been fighting on the same cards or, you know, fighting each other, et cetera. And Roy and Roy Sr. saw what happened to Gerald McClellan and basically said, no, we're not going down that road. So they actively steered him away from punchers. Now, would it have made any difference back then? I mean, did he always have a weak chin? Did it just get worse because it never got touched? I mean, I have no idea, dude. There's no answer to this. I have no clue. But if you do look on his record, you could see that he did seem to avoid a lot of the punchers in the divisions that he went through, despite the fact that his ledger is pretty damn good. James Toney, good puncher, not terrific puncher, but at middleweight, a very good middleweight and super middleweight, a very good puncher. But, you know, you could see that he never fought Michael Nunn. He never fought, some of the timing was off for some of these things too, but there was a chunk of British super middleweights that he never fought, all of whom, hit fairly hard. And I think that the quick response to that is, well, none of those guys ever really showed any interest in fighting him. That's probably true, but nonetheless, it's missing from his ledger. So I think that when you look at that, you could possibly say, oh, well, maybe that's why. Maybe that's why there weren't those punchers on his record, was because he always had a bad chin or never reacted well to being punched or, you know, punched solid or I don't know. But yeah, he definitely kind of, it was like a switch flipped, and once that switch flipped, there were no fundamentals to fall back on. And that does not seem to be the case with Lomachenko. I do worry about him on the inside if he faces somebody who can actually fight on the inside. Of course, their problem is that there isn't really anybody who can fight on the inside these days. So he doesn't have that much to worry about in there, but he does have far better fundamentals and a better fundamental understanding of what it takes to win and what it takes to be relevant and keep evolving and stay up on what's going on, you know, just continuing to improve. And I don't know that Roy ever really, I think that Roy's ego perhaps, but also his talent might have prevented him from improving in that regard. He seems like more of a person who would approach training and be like, nah, I already have what I need. You know what I mean?
I think there's truth to that. I also just think that Roy having the power that he did, having that be part of, you know, his what he brought to fights, that he could put people away with one punch in a way that Lomachenko doesn't seem to be able to. Lomachenko
That's also
seems
true, yeah.
more, you know, Lomachenko has to wear people down a little bit, break them down, and you know, overwhelm them with his output. You know, he certainly did that with Rigo, that just the punches just keep coming from the angles that these guys have never seen them come from before. And, you know, his conditioning is just so extraordinary. I think Roy was a very well-conditioned athlete, no question, but also just in a moment, just it seemed like almost more by virtue of the speed he had to put people away. Roy was never really like a really big fighter in the way that some guys are, but Lomachenko's knockouts and the knockdowns he seems to score are a result of just exquisite accuracy. I don't think Roy had to rely on that with his punches because they're just a little more powerful. But yeah, I think Lomachenko is going to be able to make adjustments. I think that probably is something he would think about. You know, I don't know where his body has been breaking down. I mean, he had a shoulder injury not long ago. But I think Roy, I think going back to what you were saying in terms of his chin, just given how young he started and how much his dad was overseeing everything and just how brutal it was, the training regimen, all the running Roy did that fucked up his knees. Like, his knees are just terrible, terrible. Like, you saw Roy, I had no idea when I saw him, just that, you know, he's like knock-kneed. You know, he can barely walk properly. Like, even his walking is just so pronounced how bad his knees are. And to think that with those knees, he's jumping in the ring against young guys and being bounced around by blows, it's ugly. Like, it was hard to watch that. You know, he can't plant your knee. It's like watch David Haye fight Tony Bellew, where one of his knees is shot. You know, it's embarrassing. Like, it's just embarrassing that they allow that to happen. Both of Roy's knees are maybe not that bad, but they're really, really bad. And he fought on them for years. So I'm not sure what kind of damage Roy sustained in terms of all the sparring he was doing early on. But, you know, I think just having worked with a lot of boxers starting out, that once they get hit, very quickly they understand if they can take a punch or they can't. So it'd be hard for me to imagine him and his dad not knowing that Roy had some issues with taking a clean shot. You know, especially probably a lot of people are trying to make a name for themselves, or certainly Big Roy was trying to show up his son by getting people in there to try to take his head off. So I'm sure some of them must have landed.
Oh man, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not like I have a concrete answer to, but it's an idea, and I think that it's a pretty it's probably more grounded in reality than anything else. But I do have to ask before we get out of here: mm-hmm. Did you catch the whole card? Did you catch that the kind of the weird ending between Charlie Edwards and Julio Cesar Martinez?
Unfortunately, I didn't, because we were watching it, a friend and me, on a phone, and the phone died. So we just saw Lomachenko, and then that was the end.
Well, I guess I could still ask. It doesn't, even if you haven't seen it.
Sure.
Excuse me. So more or less what wound up happening was Charlie, it was a flyweight fight for the WBC flyweight title. And Charlie Edwards, a kid from Surrey, UK, was fighting Julio Cesar Martinez, who's a dude from Mexico City. And Charlie Edwards, defending the title, started kind of getting beaten up a little bit by Julio Cesar Martinez. And then in round three, Martinez was really coming on and wound up kind of overwhelming Charlie Edwards and knocking him down. And right as he took a knee, Martinez kind of pivoted around him. It actually looked fairly similar to Roy Jones getting DQ'd against Montel Griffin. But but he hit him with a body shot. And it was a hard body shot. And Charlie Edwards, you know, rolled over onto his side and, you know, didn't want to continue. And initially, because of, I mean, it's kind of tough. I never want to say, oh, that was definitely intentional, because I don't know. But I could say what it looked like. It didn't really look necessarily intentional in the sense that he was like, oh, he's down, I'm fucking hitting him while he's down. It looked more like it was intentional in the sense that he was in the middle of still throwing and didn't recognize that the dude went down, or perhaps didn't, you know, it didn't fully absorb into his brain and he threw a punch. Regardless, it was still late. He was still down, so it is what it is. And I guess the only thing to figure out per the rules is whether or not it's intentional and totally subjective. So that being said, the referee had originally declared that it would be a stoppage loss for Martinez, like a knockout loss, because Charlie Edwards was not able to beat the 10 count. But within probably two and a half, 3 minutes, Mauricio Suleiman hops into the ring and says, no, actually, we're overturning that. We're going to declare it a no contest here and now, because we saw the video. Mm. And needless to say, I mean, you probably see where I'm going with this here, but it set a very weird precedent. Now, boxing's officiating is not perfect. Its officials are not perfect. Its arbitration methods are fucking stupid. You know, the powers that be are awful. The processes by which justice is purportedly served are laughable, but they are in place. And you do follow those protocols for a reason. When you follow those protocols, you know, you're able to deal with these things in a more uniform way so that you're not arbitrarily jumping into the ring and saying, nah, I think actually, as a matter of fact, we're going to do this. And so setting that precedent where Suleiman, who is the head of the WBC, which oversaw the fight, or at least oversaw the title, because the British Boxing, you know, Board of Control is what oversaw the fight. So what's not clear to me is whether or not the WBC even had the authority to step in front of the BBBOC and say, actually, no, this is our call. Because that technically should be the British board's call, whether or not it's declared a no contest or arbitrated or any of that stuff. So anyway, that's the main reason why I bring it up, is just because it sets a very weird precedent. I don't know. Ideally, I would like to see video replay used to make intelligent decisions, totally, and the correct decisions. And was this the correct decision? Probably, yeah. It probably should have been ruled a no contest, totally. But it should have gone through the process of actually doing that rather than, you know, just willy-nilly. Or at least what I viewed as willy-nilly. So I do kind of, I do have some concern about that going forward, especially with the WBC having the history that it's had, being involved with the characters that it's been involved with and had working for them. It's worrying, I would say. So for that reason, it's significant and worth bringing up. If anybody else disagrees, I'd be curious to hear about it. But anyway, hopefully that doesn't set an awful precedent.
Yeah, I just watched it now. I mean, yeah, it definitely seems like the guy's clearly down and there's a long beat before he swings the punch to hit him with that final body shot. You know, it's a pretty grievous grievous offense.
Yeah, I don't know that it warranted a DQ. I think that if he would have hit him in the head, I don't know if that necessarily even makes sense or why that would be different, but it almost feels like if he would have gone for his head or the back of his head or something like that, like that's something. But, you know, he hit him with a body shot. Like, he was going after his body in the first place, which is kind of what leads me to believe that he was just still throwing. You know, he wasn't necessarily trying to be malicious, but he was just throwing. And on top of that, it's kind of tough to discern what's fucking malice and not when they're trying to kill each other anyway. But anyway, yeah, I think the correct decision was made in making it a no contest. It's just, it was very weird.
Yeah, I don't know, because I wonder if you know, like Roy hitting Montel Griffin, that was a foul. I thought at the end of that fight, I think Griffin played it up. I think Griffin
totally
could have continued. I don't agree with that, but I mean, yeah, do we want boxing to become like soccer where everybody's flopping?
It's tough because it's like, on one hand, do you want to encourage guys to like get tapped and then just absolutely like scream in excruciating pain like a little frickin', you know, lying bastard? Or do you want to encourage somebody to keep hitting people when they're down? You know, it's tough. You do have to ride the line a little bit there.
No, I agree. I think it is tricky. You know, I'm not a big fan. I like to keep the sports more human, of instant replay coming in and slowing everything down. You know, I think it's interesting to have people judging these things. I like people judging fights as opposed to the Olympic model with computers scoring it. You know, like that way just seems so ridiculously arbitrary, of, you know, two out of three judges scoring a punch at the same, like, what the fuck? even though I disagree with judges frequently, and it's very different to watch a fight live than it is to watch it on TV. I prefer to watch it on TV to have a more objective account, I think. So this, yeah, I don't really like the precedent of, you know, all these corrupt groups that have their own self-interest in mind in trying to overturn decisions that are made by people with the authority. So it's tricky. It's a really tricky thing. You wish that people would be honest, you know, not playing up a foul to end the fight, but, you know, should that be a disqualification? I mean, where he took the body shot doesn't look that much differently to me than if he took a shot on the chin as a shot after he was down. I mean, that's where you get a body shot knockout, is where he was struck there in that foul. So I don't know.
It's a fair point. Yeah, it's tough to see it handled like that. I'd just like to see more consistency. And I guess I should also, you know, admit that a big part of the issue that I had with it was that it's Mauricio Sulaimán.
Yeah, who's a rank piece of shit from a family of rank pieces of shit. Yeah, so, yeah, I hear you, and I agree with you. And, I mean, I just think that, you know, it goes back to a more systemic thing, that you just need governance and turn boxing into a proper league where some of these, there is oversight and, as you say, consistency with something that makes sense for the welfare of the sport, as opposed to a bunch of kind of fiefdoms competing against each other for their own interests.
I think I got it.
Okay.
President of U.S. Professional Boxing.
Yep.
Bobby Chez Esquire.
Oh, I like it. Brought to
I think
you
that's where we're going.
Brought to you by Wild Turkey. If you're going to drink and drive, choose the drink responsibly if you're not going to be responsible about not drinking and driving. Wild Turkey.
And maybe Kroger, too. Maybe they want to get in on the sponsorship.
Yeah, I mean, why not? You know, these are the kind of companies that have they have the guts to stand up for a persecuted group like serial drunk drivers. And, you know, I'm not going to commend them for it, but I think if Dave Chappelle does another comedy special, he probably might.
Well, we're going to get Amnesty International on this, like, ASAP. So we'll see where it goes. But in the meanwhile, hopefully everybody enjoyed our late bashing of Bobby Chez and our comparison between Vasily Lomachenko and Roy Jones Jr. Hopefully that pisses a bunch of people off into actually listening to the show. Yeah.
Blame Bobby.
All right, everybody. Well, honestly, though, thank you for listening in. If you did listen in, we really do appreciate it. And if you're on Twitter, follow us there. Follow Bryn at Brynicio. Brynicio. And also follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. And also, if you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page on Facebook. Throw us a like. And wherever it is you're listening to your podcast now and rating them, throw us a rating there. That's about it. Bryn, you're beautiful.
All right, guys. Take care.
Take it easy, everybody.